Shalom all, welcome to our Kosher Torah Open Forum for tonight. It is the 30th of July in the year 2012. I have my August calendar up here and I was just looking at the dates saying, gee, we're not in August yet, but we're getting there. So anyway, welcome all. I am, of course, your host, Ariel Bar Tzedok. Of course, you find me at koshertorah.com. This is our fifth class now in our series in the laws of the occult. We are learning from the Code of Jewish Law, the Shulchan Aruch, in the second section called Yod HaDe'ah in 179. We are now going to conclude this section, learning laws 15 through 19. We have to always, document what we're doing here so people have a framework. Now, we're going to discuss what we would today commonly call magic. And when I use the term magic, I am not referring to sorcery or wizardry. I'm referring to magic, if you will, Las Vegas style. The likes of a David Copperfield, Chris Angel, and all the rest of these show magicians. I don't know if any of you have ever watched show magicians before, but man, they come out with some really good tricks. I've seen them, not so much live, because I'm not one to go to shows, but I've seen them on television and other medias, and boy, what they do really looks convincing. To a point that I knew one person who swore to me, he must be using real sorcery. To which, of course, you smile and said, no, it's all tricks. Well, there was a program somewhere in the world of cable television out there. I think it was the Magician's Secrets Revealed, wherein which they had the masked magician. And he would demonstrate all these tricks, which again looked very impressive. I mean, sawing the woman in half and all these other strange things. And then they would show exactly how it was done. And needless to say, it is all showmanship. Now, when you and I go to Vegas today, if we were going to go and see a show, whether it was David Copperfield, Chris Angel, any one of these stage magicians, we would be awed and awed, and we would, applaud and all the rest. But we know very well that there's no real sorcery or wizardry going on here. But it's all what we call, smoke and mirrors or sound and light show. This is important, and I'm going to tell you why. Because today, we know that that's what it is. We might not know how the magic tricks are done, but we know that they're tricks. Why is this important? Because in ancient times, this was not known. If you go and study ancient religious rites, more so in the Greco-Roman era than anywhere else, the priests in the ancient temples would put on shows. That was the form of the ritual worship, wherein which, if you will, things as if came alive. When we look at ancient temples and ancient religions, all we see are these ruins, these alabaster or stone ruins. And we think that's the way things looked then. They most certainly did not. When you see buildings like the Parthenon and the Colosseum and all the rest of these old places, well, of course the Colosseum is for entertainment, but the old temples were painted in multiple colors. The gods inside that you see as statues were painted to look real. Now, you've seen figures in wax museums, of course, the Believe It or Not museums or Madame Tussauds Wax Museum or something like that. These things look really real. Well, that's the way they made the old gods look. And many a time, the priests would somehow put either a person or some kind of an echoing device inside a god. So when someone would go to a god to pray, they would say something, and the priest would answer and make it look like it was the god himself who was answering. So, in that day, this is what the people believed. People were on the impression that the gods were real and really did listen to them. Now, in all due respect in ancient idolatry, when somebody went and built a statue, they knew it was made out of stone or wood, but they somehow felt that it could become possessed by a power. And that is what they hoped for. And of course, the priests would make their dreams come true. If you and I were to go and say to somebody, you know something, that's not really the God talking to you. That's just, you know, somebody playing a game on you. That would have been considered blasphemous. That could have provoked a violent response, which could have gotten you beaten up, if not killed. I'll give you an example. I remember many years ago, I was giving a lesson in a public forum on the history and relationship of Christmas and Hanukkah. And I had mentioned in the lesson that it's well known that the Christian church adopted December 25th as the supposed day of the birth of Yeshu, based upon an older Roman holiday called the Saturnalia. That is originally pagan origins. And I had somebody who supposedly was a friend literally almost went to run at the stage in anger, wanting to attack me. How dare I speak such blasphemy against Yeshu? Literally, the person was violent. And I was held back, and I said, what on earth is wrong? They went nuts. Until finally, I had to wave the papers in front of them. I said, this information, it's not from a Jewish source. I said, this information comes from the Vatican Catholic Encyclopedia. The Catholic Church itself acknowledges it. What is wrong with you? But you see, when you challenge people's beliefs, this is what they call iconoclastic. You know, some people can't handle it. People would fake them. They would dupe them. This was called, in the language of our sages, ochez et ha'anayim, which means to grasp the eyes. But in other words, it meant to trick people. So, to trick people. That obviously was done for the sake of perpetuating their beliefs. Our sages put their foot down and said, that is definitively wrong. And the question in those days was this a real sound and light or smoke and mirror show? Like we would see today in the Las Vegas Magic Act? Or was there some real sorcery or wizardry involved? Because even though our sages would say, you know, come on, somebody's, you know, pulling your leg. There's a very famous story about this in the Apocrypha, with an added chapter in the book of Daniel, in which we have a case in point in this respect. It made it look like the idols were actually eating the food that they would leave behind them. It was actually the priests coming in, you know, stealing and making it look like the idols ate. That's ochez et ha'anayim. That's stealing the eyes or stealing the mind. All right? Tricking. But is there real wizardry? The answer is absolutely yes. And this is why it states here in law number 15. V'cheset et ha'enayim asur, to grasp the eyes, like we've just been saying, is forbidden. V'al yedei sefer yetzirah mutar. However, if one is using the sefer yetzirah, it is permissible. And the Ramah adds, afilu lasot maaseh, not only to make it look like you're doing something, but to even actually do something. Now, this is the issue. Ever since, even before since Torah was given at Mount Sinai, the entire purpose of human evolution on the face of this planet is to evolve beyond our physical forms in the limitations of our primitive minds, to expand and to become the greater creatures that we were meant to be. Going back to the beginning, this is taught very clearly in the Torah of the Arizal. It's echoed in numerous literature thousands of years before that, so the Ari didn't really invent anything here. The original Adamic race was not physical in a body of flesh and blood, but it was in a body of light. And that which we call the original story of the Garden of Eden, it's different from how people interpret it literally. Our sages go to great ends to tell us the stories in Genesis are not literal. And of course, like violent people wanting to jump at stages, they sometimes can't handle that, and that's just too bad. Well, I can't get into the entire issue of the fall in the Garden of Eden. I've discussed that in numerous other material. It's available in my lessons on the book of Genesis. It's, again, available in MP3 formats on koshertorah.com. But let me just get back to business here. The purpose of the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai was to offer us like a lifesaver, a life preserver as we're drowning in the sea, so we can grab onto it and pull ourselves out. Pulling ourselves out of what? Pulling ourselves out of the illusions that this physical world is where it's at. Now, we are here. We're here for a reason. We're here for a purpose. This is our job. But performing our job at this time doesn't make this our home. And therefore, the entire purpose and everything in the Holy Torah was to teach humanity how to evolve. This was what was taught in the original school of the prophets in biblical times. How to expand the human mind. How to go beyond the limitations of the parameters of the physical world of space and time around us. When a prophet went into this reality, it expanded everything around them. And it changed everything. Prophets, therefore, became known as masters of miracles, simply because their mind existed in a quantum state of fluctuation, wherein which realities were not concrete but fluid, and therefore, based upon the needs of the moment and the time, could change things, even from lead to gold. You know where I'm getting at with that. Prophets did things like this. This was their nature. Even though prophecy ceased with the concealment of the Ark of the Covenant, of course, the connections never ceased. The teachings never ceased. The teachings of how to expand the mind have never been lost. They have been taught and practiced in Torah circles, literally, in a straight line, what we call a Masorah, a tradition, an unbroken chain, from the days of earliest antiquity, probably from Adam, Certainly. Noah, Enoch before him, Abraham after him, Moses to this very day. Prophets, what we call Anashay, you know, the people, I was about to say, people of who could do tremendous things. In our mystical Talmud class, How to Live a Godly Life, we've discussed this in some detail, the lives of people like Honi, the circle maker. Well, these types of things are still done today by those who know how to do it. And I emphasize those who know how to do it are very few and far between. The material, the literature that we have that actually teaches this stuff, when read by people who do not understand it, they never get the picture. And I'll share with you a story. When I was beginning my Kabbalistic studies years and years ago, I had studied the traditional books in the traditional yeshivot, and I'm not going to name drop. But when I went and met my one teacher, and he asked me what I had learned. And I mentioned this book and that book and that book and this book. And then he started to ask me questions. And I could drop a hat, bam, ask the question, I got the answer. I was smart in those, my younger years, not like the old fart I've become today. And his questions kept getting harder and harder and harder and harder. Until finally, I looked at him and said, wait a second. Where are these questions coming from? They're not written in any book. And he said to me words that I will remember to this very day. B'ni, achshav sheta lamadata makatuv besvarim, ani elemed lecha ech lahavinam. Translate, my son, now that you learn what's written in the books, I'm going to teach you how to understand it. And my Rebbe and I sat together one-on-one every afternoon for a couple of years. And he showed me how things were understood. And if it wasn't for that key that opened the door, I would have been like everybody else, reading the books, thinking I understand them, and interpreting what we call the secrets of the Torah, Sodot HaTorah, in the same academic, intellectual format that intellectual academic people look at everything else. There is, as Rabbi Yosef Chaim, the famous Ben Ish Chai Baghdad says, what we call the Pshat of Sod and the Sod of Sod. There is the intellectual level and there's the psychic level. It's the psychic level that I so desperately endeavor not only to teach but to get you guys connected to. And literally, I feel like I'm pulling teeth. I guess maybe that's just the way it is. I've taught the Sefer Yetzirah. Unlike many of the commentaries who try to go into long intellectual and philosophical teachings, I teach you how to use it. I am right now dating myself, writing and teaching and an instruction on how to use the name Yudke Vavke, based upon material that I originally released in my book, Call Upon My Name, my first book written over 20 years ago. And new material that I've never before revealed. You'll see it. It's available on koshertorah.com. But you see, when you learn these matters properly and you transform your mind and consciousness properly, this was an entirely different special school. You'll find it referred to in later Kabbalistic literature as the school of the Mit Bodedim, or the meditators, or the secluded ones, depending on how you want to interpret the word. Rabbi Chaim Vital in his Sha'ari Kedusha talks about them, and I have the lessons for Sha'ari Kedusha available special for my live students tonight. For those of you who haven't taken it, you should take advantage of this. It says that there was a man who approached these secluded ones, these people who've gotten to the level of prophecy, and he says, I want to be like you. And the master says, oh really? Tell us about yourself. Says, well, I'm a religious man. I study the Torah. I give a lot of charity. I do all these good things. I am well versed. I am learned. I am ready to go. And the leader says to him, oh, you are you? Because this is what I want you to do. I want you to go to the public market and buy a bag of candy. And then I want you to put up a sign and say, all children who want some free candy, come here and slap me in the face. Slap me in the face and I'll give you free candy. The man is appalled. He says, what are you talking about? I'm an honored, respected man of the community. I have to have my honor, my kavod. I can't do anything like that. And maybe it's only my ears, but I hear the master talking like in the voice of Master Yoda, saying, oh, hard and difficult this is for you, eh? This is the easiest thing that you would have to do. My teacher always reminded me of Yoda. Even though Yoda's a little green puppet, it represents the small, which contains so much. The message that this man couldn't handle was a biblical message. You want to walk in the way of connection, then you have to let go of solid reality and walk in a quantum state of fluctuation. Not for naught were the biblical prophets called meshuggah, crazy, because they didn't hold on to the same values as the rest of you do. This is a transformational process. It's not a decision you can make. It's just natural. So when one practices the Sefer Yetzirah and learns the appropriate meditative techniques to go into a quantum state of reality, wherein which everything is not concrete, but rather fluctuating, and anything you look at can be this or that. And that's the secret. Even the great Kiddushat Levi, who is a famous Hasidic author, says, this is the secret of turning lead to gold. Yes, alchemy. It can be done. It has been done. It is done. Mind over matter is real for those who know how to do it. There is a group of Tibetan monks that have been medically documented can go into a state of meditation in a cold room, as cold as a refrigerator, and they can take blankets, immerse them in cold water, and wrap their bodies in them, and through their meditation raise their skin temperature up over 17 degrees hotter than the body. 98.6 plus 17, you do the math. And it's been filmed. I've seen it. The steam rising off the blankets as they're able to dry it through the meditative process. Mind over matter. It works. Oh, well, those are the Tibetan monks. Yeah. It is also known of the great rabbis who would do this. There was one rabbi, again, I'm not going to name drop for you. He would go up to the famous mikvah of the Ari in Sfat, Safed, in Israel. Anybody's ever been there, you know, it's this pool in a cave. And it's not what I would call the warmest in the world. It is freezing. This rabbi would go in there without anyone else following him. And then when he was ready, he would come out and people would go in and the water was steaming. He did the same thing. Okay? Now, this is the power of mind over matter. This is what the Sefer Yetzirah teaches. Rabbis, to a point, had this knowledge. The rabbis in the days of the Second Temple clearly had this ability. The rabbis after the fall of the Temple had this ability. We know the famous examples of Rabbi Akiva, that which is attributed to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Rabbi Yehuda, the prince, the master of the Mishnah. I've spoken about him in my Wednesday night How to Live a Godly Life course when we spoke about spirits and the like. Rabbi Yehuda, after he died, would come Friday nights back to his house and do Kiddush for his family. because he was alive in the Force. Kind of like that glittery, glowing body of Obi-Wan Kenobi kind of thing. He knew this. Throughout the generations, the rabbis in the Talmud know about this. There are famous reports that we have in the Talmud that the rabbis would study these laws of Yetzirah and were able to use them to create animals, people, and the like. The story of the famous golem. Now, whether the story of the golem created by Rabbi Yehuda Low of Prague, whether that's a true story or fiction, let the scholars debate and argue that one. But the foundation is real. And it's not like you need clay to make a golem. You can actually create a golem out of thin air. These things are real. This is what's referred to here as doing actual things with the power. Now notice here, we're not invoking any angels. We're not even calling upon God. This is the power inherent within us as human beings. And every one of us, male, female, Jewish, non-Jewish, doesn't matter. And who says? Well, Elijah the prophet said so, Eliyahu Navi. Where? Tana de Eliyahu, Eliyahu Rabban, 9th chapter. Those of you who know Hebrew, go look it up. Those are his words, not mine. Good enough for Prophet Elijah, good enough for me. That's why I open Kosher Torah up to all souls who want to learn. If you're here, you're meant to be here. That's what counts. These teachings are not lost. However, something happened. I think I understand what happened. Maybe there's more to it than what I understand, but here we go. We see that up until about the year 1000, the rabbis in ancient times, in the generations of rabbis who we call the Rishonim, this is up in the about the year 1000, 1100, 1200, 1300, 1400, 1500, apparently they knew this material. The story of these mitbodedim, this happened in Jerusalem in the 1500s, 1400s maybe. There were these groups who safeguarded this knowledge, but something happened. Maybe it was the Renaissance in Europe, I'm not sure. There arose a type of a rabbi, pious and righteous, but who were completely disconnected, unattached to this knowledge. That their entire path to Torah, mitzvot, was completely academic and intellectual, without the experiential element whatsoever. Now, I might add, that most certainly did not include Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Code of Jewish Law. We know he had a magid, a spiritual guide, and the dictionary of that material is available even in English today. But something happened with a great number of rabbis, specifically in Eastern Europe, our brothers, the Ashkenazim, who lost contact with this experiential side of our ancient traditions. The academic side of the mysticism, many of them embraced. Many books, many profound, very good ones, have come out of those sources. But very few. In the days of Rabbi Yosef Karo and beyond, very, very few had knowledge of the experience. One, only one of the most famous, who we can mention, was the founder of the Hasidic movement, Rabbi Israel ben Eliezer. He is the founder of the Hasidic movement. Do you remember what we call him? We call him the Baal Shem Tov. Why? Baal, master, Shem Tov, of the good name. He was called the master of the good name. Why? Because Rabbi Yisrael was not known for his homiletic teachings. He wasn't known for his ethical and moral parables. He wasn't a wandering teacher spreading just joy and love. He was a miracle worker. He had powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. And, according to certain circles, he belonged to a certain group of these concealed ones. And yet, the knowledge of these concealed ones became lost. And so, when we learn about this material, in the writings of the rabbis who write about it, they're writing about it from the outside, from the external sources, who don't seem to understand what it is all about. So, when the code here says, stealing the eyes, tricking people, is forbidden, but by the Sefi Yetzirah, it's permitted. Well, you're never tricking people by the Sefi Yetzirah. The Sefi Yetzirah can create imagery in people's minds, yes. But more so, it teaches you the quantum reality to actually fundamentally change reality. And this can be done, and as the Rama states, even to do action. This is well known. When you read the commentaries on this material, you'll find how the rabbis say, oh, we don't know how to do this. No one can do this today. We don't have the level of holiness and the levels of purity to accomplish this. Well, that's not what it was about. In all due respect, the rabbis were saying these words, claiming that they don't have the holiness and the purity. Sure they do. The rabbis who wrote these words are as holy and as pure as those who came before them. What they lacked was the knowledge. They were, unfortunately, not in that circle that they knew. And it's a shame. In my opinion, it's heartbreaking. Because if they had this knowledge, and I'm not the first to say this, when the Nazis came to power, they would have known how to handle them. Just like the rabbis in the land of Israel did. So, this is what we have to deal with. We have generations now, centuries of rabbis, more so of the Eastern European persuasion, who write commentary and commentary about academic, intellectual matters, because they have no experiential knowledge of these things. Again, with very rare and few exceptions. And they are out there. I mean, you might have heard of the famous book of the angel Raziel. Many of you might not be familiar with the famous book of the angel Raphael. I teach some things from that book from time to time. Many of these texts of practical usages have always been there. I endeavor to teach them. Now, we're going to go off into a different topic. It's again a topic which these great and holy sages knew the laws of, but never knew the reality underlying them. You had rabbis like Maimonides, who I think must have known about the ancient mystical traditions, because I see it echoed in his Guide to the Perplexed. I see it echoed in his Laws of the Foundations of Torah, which again are available on koshertorah.com. And yet, he seems to deny certain things which contradict our sages themselves. And this has opened a door for many who therefore attack our sages, even in the religious communities, and lead them to conclusions about reality which are fundamentally flawed. When the rationalist says, I only believe what my eyes can see, I have said over and over again, gee, what a prison your mind must be. Because if you said those words in the years 1812, look how limited your understanding of the reality would be. If you said those words in 1912, look how limited your reality would be. And now you're going to say these words in 2012, and you don't think your reality is equally limited? God bless us. Life should go on. Time should move on. Without destroying ourselves, what do you think technology will advance to in the year 2112? 2212? 3212? Can you imagine? We can't even think that. We can't even imagine. And yet, all that will be discovered is already there right now. We just haven't seen it yet because we don't know how to look. Well, one of those things that our sages have spoken about, echoed in the words of the Bible, certainly echoed throughout Talmudic and other literature of the time, Qumranic literature and everywhere else, is that we are not alone on our planet. We are not at the top of the food chain. We are not alone here on this planet. We're not the only intelligent race. There are others. In ancient Greek literature, they were called daemons. We call them today spirits, simply because their physical makeup is in some ways different from us. This is an intentional pause here because I'm trying to say how much should I reveal and how much shouldn't I reveal. Well, let's open up. God created other species. Today we call them demons. Now, in the text here, as we were beginning, someone was asking, well, gee, aren't these demons like all bad and evil and they're the fallen angels and enemies of God and servants of Satan? And the answer is, well, no, that's not true. That is Christian mythology, which actually has its source in Mithraic, Zoroastrian, and Babylonian teachings, not from original biblical teachings. That's clear from the books of Enoch. There are fallen angels. We read about them in Genesis 6. But they are clearly and definitively extraterrestrial. They were physical, humanoid, flesh and blood type guys who came down from outer space. Really? Who says? Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, the late great Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva at the University in Yeshiva Brisk from Chicago. May he rest in peace. How do I know? I saw it written in his name, and his son confirmed to me that was his father's opinion. That's how I know. So now, the fallen angels we read about in Genesis 6, they're kind of like not good guys. And yet, they are here on earth to this very day doing what they got to do by God's design. In other words, even though they might have fallen, even though they're going to get it, they're still having to serve heaven because that's what their obligations are. Now, I'm talking about other indigenous races. Rabbi Chaim Vital, in his Etz Chaim, writes about them. And right now in my How to Live a Godly Life class, we're talking about King Solomon and the famous story of Ashmodai and King of the Demons. And I'm expounding on all of this in there. If you're a member of that, if you're registered in that series, you'll understand this. If not, you might want to purchase those classes online. Three different indigenous species, Rav Chaim writes. And quoting from earlier sources, specifically an ancient commentary to the Pirkei Avot, these Shedim, as they are called in Hebrew, in three ways are like angels and in three ways are like human beings. This is from Avot, the Rabbi Natan. They are like angels in that they can be invisible, they travel in the air, and they can see about 30 days into the future. But like human beings, they eat and drink, sexually procreate, and they die. Out of these three, two of them are considered to be harmful to humanity, like wild animals out in the field, and they will take advantage if they can because they look at human beings as sources of food. Their food, of course, is what we call life force energy. That's why our sages say stay away from them. But yet there was a third group. A third group who were said to be fearers of God, righteous. And in that, they serve God and seek to do His will. They are called, if you will, righteous demons. But again, being that we consider the term demon to be, you know, you know, satanic minions of the devil. We would never think of putting the word good with demons together, but as we have learned, that's just not true. There is no Satan out there duking it out with God for your soul. That's a myth. The book of Job makes it very clear. Satan is an angel, a messenger, a servant who serves heaven. That's his job. And he has no power other than what is given to him in heaven. People are very superstitious. They're very fearful of the unknown. So much so that they don't even want to say the word shadim. They would say shindalitz, please. The good ones out there you don't have to worry about. They can actually be of help and support. King Solomon found that out, as we learn about in the Talmud. This is a very famous foundation for what we call a pseudepigraphal work called the Testament of Solomon. That it was actually able, it's based upon a verse in Scripture, that Solomon had the demons actually subdued to his will and helped him in the building of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. Now, they didn't do it as unwilling slaves. No, they did it as willing. They were very, very desirous to help and serve because, as I said, there were some who were good guys. And so, what is our relationship with these other races? Well, for those who are aware and can distinguish between the good and the bad, they are ruled by one law. But how many know that? Did you know before this class, moments ago, that there are actually good spirits out there, as opposed to all the bad ones? Do you know, even now, how to tell the difference? No, you don't. You might think you do. Just because they come to you and say, I am a good spirit. The ones who come to you and say, I'm a good spirit, those are the ones you got to watch out for, first of all. Right? No. It's dangerous stuff. And therefore, we've always been warned. This is not something that people should dabble with. We read and learned about the famous story of Rabbi Yosef Delarina, who sought to attack the harmful forces, to subdue them to his will, and how they fought back, and how he lost. Go online. You can get the MP3 learning series about that. Even though it's not a special for tonight, if you're interested, I'll get you a deal on it. Code of Law, Law 16, states, Ma'asei shedim asur. Acts with demons are prohibited. Can we actually, through sorcery, invoke demons, good or bad? Yes. Can we entice them to come to us? Yes. Can we offer them something to work in our favor? Yes. As I said, they eat energy. Offer them energy, and you'll have them eating out of your hand. Until, of course, they might bite your hand off. We don't do this. I'll explain in the next few laws exact details. But I want you to know and understand that these entities are real. Our sages speak about them very clearly. And those rationalists will say, oh, it's nonsense. Okay, for you it's nonsense. Good for you. That's fine. No arguments. Our sages are wrong. Scriptures are wrong. Everything is wrong because you're right and that's just the way it has to be. So, fine. The yesh mi shematir lishal behem al geniva. We don't interact with demons, but the code here says very clear there are those who permit for you to ask them about the identity of a thief. Remember, these entities travel in an energetic world. They can read the minds of people like we would read a newspaper. That's how these mediums and psychics work. They contact the spirit, and the spirit gets any information they want. So, if and when there is an issue, such as finding the identity of a thief, we can contact these lower people, these lower entities, and find out. He said, why don't you talk to the angels? Well, maybe the angels are busy doing other things. These entities are a lot easier to contact. And again, the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Sulis, writes like this: the Keyotze Bizeh, and things similar to this. Alright? Al Yidei Hashpa'a Shemashpia Otam Al Yidei Shemot. And if you're going to invoke demons, not by offering them things, but by calling upon them by the holy names of God, Yish Mitrim B'Kol Inyan. He says, that you could do anything. If you're going to, like King Solomon did, compel them by the holy name of God, that you can do. That, he says, is permissible to do with everything. And he even says that comes from Rabbi Yosef Karo himself. And he concludes here this section with a very strong warning, which echoes out of the schools of those people who knew darn well what they were talking about. Makom, makom. Rov ha'asokim bezeh, eda niftari mehem b'shalom. That therefore the majority of people who deal with this kind of stuff, they don't exit from this in peace. Alright? Alken shomer nafsho yirhak mehem. Therefore, guard yourself. Stay away. So, I am not really into telling people, oh, let's go invoke the demons and find out the identity of this or that. Not a good idea. Oh, but I want to see them. Not a good idea. The spirits are out there. They inhabit the forests. They inhabit the mountains. They inhabit the deserts. We call them by all different kinds of names today. I've seen them. Looking at the list of people who are here in this live class, I know other people who have seen them too. They're there. Not always bad, but don't mess with them. That's my word of advice. Law 17. Hanohagim laaruch shulchan. Ones who will arrange a table. Im kol minei ma'achal. With all different types of food. Belil ha'mila. On the night before a circumcision. And then they say, Shehu l'mazal ha'tinok. We set this table with all this food because it's for the benefit of the child, for his good luck, his mazal. This is forbidden. Because this ultimately is how the entities are called and brought in. They literally siphon the psychic energy out of the food as an offering. This is a popular tradition, surprisingly, in many of the old superstitious circles. Don't do this. This is also the foundation why, if and when you ever involved in any practice which requires putting even things as simple and benign as fruit or flowers on an altar, which makes it forbidden. I remember many, many years ago when I was living in a little town in Iowa called Fairfield. It was the home of one of the most notorious cults of the day, the Transcendental Meditation Movement. Little town of 10,000 people, 3,000 Jewish people were there, involved with this cult. And I was there trying to get people out. So I went there to teach them meditation. They wanted to teach me meditation. So I said, okay, show me your stuff. So they said, well, we can't do it to you until you do an initiation ceremony, which they call a puja. I said, oh, what does that involve? And they said, well, you're going to go and do this and this and this, and then you're going to take some flowers or some fruit, and you're going to put it on this like little altar with the picture of their guru there, and they're going to do a recitation chant. And I said, oh, really? I said, no, that violates the biblical law of idolatry. No, 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 that is a thou shalt not. You don't put any flowers anywhere. You don't put any fruit anywhere. So some said, well, they'll do it in your name. No, 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 you're doing nothing in my name, thank you. They could never teach me because I wouldn't do their initiation ceremony because I saw through it. That's why I've always said that transcendental meditation is not just a meditative technique. It is a religion, and it is a religion of idolatry by Jewish law. And I know a lot of people who practice might get upset by that, but let the truth be told. What can I say? Now, with that being said, we don't do things like this. It is dangerous. There are many superstitions with this, saying you don't leave liquids out at night. You don't leave food under a bed. or anything of the kind wherein which these entities are going to be naturally attracted to it. Now, those of you who don't know, I live in a rural area. And outside here in the woods, I get all kinds of critters floating around there at night. All kinds. What do you think would happen if I took a spread of food and I laid it out on the lawn there? You think it would be there in the morning? I would find the rabbits. I would find the coons. We got wild boar out in the forest. We got bears. Boy, oh boy, I might be having encounters of a strange kind that I don't even want to know about what would be coming down from the woods. All the more so whatever other entities might be interested, especially if that was my intent. Remember, intent plays a big deal in this. Now, not only is offering food, flowers, or anything of a kind with the intent, because remember, they're reading your mind, so they're recognizing your intent. If I go and take the garbage and I throw it out, that's not exactly an offering that's going to get anybody interested to come around. They might still eat of it, but they're not going to be saying, "Oh, gee, thanks, now I owe you one, buddy." I don't think so. Law 18. The katir habayit be'esiv sheyishlo re'ach tov yish mi she'oser ela im ken oseken kedei la'asir ruach ra, re'ach ra, excuse me. I don't know if you can hear a good old Texie out there barking. Sometimes in the middle of night, all right, I can be wide awake and I know I'm not hearing anything. And I can see him like just twist his head and look. And I can see him following something out in the woods. I have flashlights, I have everything. Can't see anything. I don't know what he's seeing. But anyway, getting back to this. To burn incense in your house, a good-smelling fragrance, there are those who forbid you to do it, other than if and when you're doing it specifically for the case of getting rid of a bad smell. Burning incense is a clear way to invite in foreign entities. Right? They just come after the smell. Even perfumes can be dangerous in that respect, even though they're not burning. But the smell, the fragrance of the smoke, especially, is dangerous. That's how Rabbi Yosef del Arena got caught. So be very, very careful when you offer incense. Many people never think, and I wrote an essay about this, it's on koshertorah.com, entitled, "Is Your Incense Kosher?" Are you allowed to burn incense? Of course you are. But that is a common practice today, but its origins come from a time when people would burn these fragrances with a specific intent to invite in spirits. Now, I have a special combination of things that I put together, which are specifically used and designed to cleanse a place from any noxious spirits that just don't belong. In other words, they take a whiff, ugh, and they leave. Well, that's the way it's supposed to work, and usually it does. No, I don't reveal what my formula is, and no, I don't sell it. I keep that, private. Some things are just not meant for public usage, but it's always worked for me. But yet, when you go to the store to buy incense, look at where it's made. Look at how it's used. Now, somebody here in the comment section has mentioned white sage, to burn the sage. That is a Native American practice here in North America. That is not a tradition that I received. I don't burn white sage. I don't know really what it does. In all due respect, it's not like I go up to the spirits and say, "Hey, smell this, tell me what you think." We're not that intimate with one another, in all due respect. I know what I received from my traditions, so that's what I do. So I can't endorse, or for that matter, condemn white sage, even though however popular it is. But again, when you go to the store today and you look at incenses, you see these sticks come from all of these different temples from other foreign religions, and they say dedicated to this temple or dedicated to this god. Absolutely, positively forbidden to be used. Don't mess around. Don't say, but I'm not into it. Doesn't matter. The energy's in it. Remember, we live in an energy universe. Everything revolves around energy. It's another thou shalt not. Be careful what you burn and how you burn it. Okay? Law 19. And with this, we are going to conclude this section. Hamikatel l'shed l'chaviro u'l'kafo l'asot k'eritzono chayav mishum oved avodat kochavim. The one who is burning incense to attract the spirit, the entity, in order to be friends with him or to compel him to do your will. This makes one guilty of the crime of idolatry. Bottom line, can it be done? Yes. These entities who are out there have their own lives, their own purposes, their own functions. And it is not to be taken prisoner by you or me or anyone else, to be used and forced and compelled to do something that they don't want. That is slavery, and that is evil and wrong. And don't you think they don't take revenge at the first opportunity? That's what we learned above, where it's stated, don't mess with this stuff, because people who do don't walk away from this in peace. Now, for those who know God's names, for those who work with the good entities and work with them for proper and holy usage, who are they? Few and far between. King Solomon. Anything more than that should remain a secret. Well, we don't do that today. And if there are those who do, well, that's, I guess, one of those other secrets. But we have to recognize that these things are real. We must not allow ourselves to be seduced by superstitions or irrational fears. I know people who go running to the Kabbalists, spending thousands of dollars. Why? Oh, somebody put the evil eye on me. Oh, somebody's doing witchcraft to me. Help, help, get it off. Icky, icky, icky. Come on. A person like that needs a good kick in the pants more than anything else. That's not the way things are. That's not the reality of this. Please, don't call me up in tears saying, I got the evil eye on me. Help me remove it. Oh, I'll tell you exactly what to do. I wrote a whole book on it called Protection from Evil. Go get it. Learn. The power's in your hands. There's no superstition, hocus pocus going on here. We just live in a greater world. We're here to learn about it. And that is actually where we conclude these laws. The final law of this section states, Halomed mina amgushi afilu divrei Torah, if you were to learn from a person called an Amgushi, even if you learned from them Torah, they said that's makes you guilty of the death penalty. An Amgushi is a Persian word, from what I understand. And it was a type of a sorcerer and a practitioner of black magic who specifically went to invoke and to compel these demonic elements to force them to do their will. This is what we call dark arts, black magic, bad guys. If they are going to trap and corral in spirit entities, you can just imagine that they're doing what they would do to fellow human beings. These guys are bad dudes because all they want is control, power, and to make themselves up and at the same time make you down. Alright? Bad news, people. These are what we call the Amgushi. Now, the commentary states something very, very interesting. That even though you're not supposed to learn from these people, you're not supposed to learn from them anything to do. However, it is permitted to learn from them sorcery. Why? So that you can understand how sorcery works, what its parameters are, and therefore you can recognize it when you see it and know how to neutralize it when you're exposed to it. So in that respect, you are allowed to learn these things. Ultimately, manipulating spiritual forces outside the parameters of the service of God is what the Bible calls strange or foreign activity, or we call in English idolatry. Idolatry is not just simply calling something that's not God, God, but it's also manipulating higher forces and to get them to act in place of God, to do your will instead of the will of God being done. In that respect, many people have turned many things into idols. They not only invoke demons, they can invoke governments, politics, money, power. All kinds of isms and things can become idolatry. Learning about these things to protect yourself, in my opinion, is vital. That's why I teach this material. Because unlike the rabbis of Eastern Europe, who only can speak about this stuff theoretically, because frankly, they've never spoken to a shed. They know nothing about what a shed is. They don't know what an amgushi is. They know nothing about these things. In Talmudic times, our sages were well versed in these. There is a very famous Talmudic story, 100+ years before the destruction of the temple. One of the great rabbis, Shimon ben Shetach, had to infiltrate a coven of witches down by Ashdod. And he knew exactly how to neutralize what was their real actual power. Because remember, going into quantum fluctuations of reality doesn't require holiness. It just requires an alternation of consciousness. Anybody can do it. What you do in that state defines the difference between holy and unholy. Holy means that you go there to surrender and support the will of God. Unholy means you go in there to serve your own purposes. I have a question here in text about mystical studies. Why do these rabbis say to stay away from these until the age of 40? The Eastern European rabbis who couldn't understand this, again, interpreted this mystical materials in their intellectual academic framework, thinking that it was a level of intellectual academic accomplishment that if they couldn't understand, how could you? Well, those of the mystical Ben realize it's not on the rungs of a ladder that you get to a level of accomplishment and then you take one step. No, they're two totally separate paths. And one who's on the left path will never understand those who are on the right. And that's just the way it is. And just for the record, according to Jewish law that the Sephardim have always known, Rabbi Avadia Yosef has written that mystical studies is permissible from the age of 20 and on, being that he speaks within the context of the writings of the Lurianic, the Kabbalah of the Ari. He says that a person should even be married. Why? Because many of the philosophical concepts there are described using very overtly erotic terminology, and not the type of terminology and concepts that single people should be focusing and thinking about. So, he says you should be married, but 20 years old, not 40. But again, to emphasize and to conclude, experience is everything, and theory is nothing. Let's use the example of eroticism, sexuality. Think about this. If you were to go to college and get a PhD in sex, we all know what sex is. Let's say you read every book ever written. You know all about the biology. You've read every dirty book, every dirty poem. You've seen all the dirty movies. And yet, you have never had any physical contact with a member of the opposite sex. You've never had any kind of sexual arousal or ejaculation of any kind. What good is all that PhD level knowledge that you have accomplished in compared to one who has actually had the experience of the coupling and the physical doing? Who knows more? And you can say, well, the types of knowledge are different. Who knows more? Who knows what it's really all about? Obviously, you must admit the one with experience knows a lot more than the one who doesn't. The one who has no experience knows a lot, but he just doesn't get it. Because he just can't see, can't grasp, can't know. That's what it is with this material. The laws of the occult govern relationship. But a point that's made throughout here is that the authors of these laws were people of experience who culled these laws over centuries based on experience, who know what they're talking about and know whom they're talking to. So ultimately, their words are not just wise advice. They're not called laws for nothing. They're there to keep us safe and therefore incumbent upon us to pay attention, to learn and to observe. And I pray that as we evolve and grow and mature and become that which we are meant to be, beings of luminescent light, not just beings of flesh in this crude matter, we will know, we will experience, we will understand, we'll see with our own eyes. That's everything that I teach at KosherTorah.com. I want to thank you all for joining me for this series. And as God be willing, I'll see you in our next class. Thank you again. God bless you all. Shalom.